My name is Mary Hathaway, and I was raising little kids. In fact, our third was born in 66. So I wasn't gung-ho for committee work and meetings and stuff like that, but my husband was more available for that. And we had come to know some new people in town, David Werfel and Kathy. David was an expert in Southeast Asian politics, and he was well known to Russell Fuller and Barbara Fuller, and they became our friends, just more or less just as friends. They were having little kids and we had little kids, so in that sense I knew what was going on, but I wasn't being active myself. John was invited to go to Paris along with Barbara Fuller and Jack somebody. I'm sure it's in that book.
John, your husband?
Yeah, John, my husband. So that he could ask tough questions if there was a chance. And then when he came back, of course, the idea was to tell the community what they had learned there. And John, being a Republican, would have access to people who wouldn't listen to Democrats or liberals coming back. Which isn't to say that my husband wasn't liberal. He was. They used to have such a thing as liberal Republicans in those days. And he was one. He had a very open mind, and it was just fun to be with him. So that was in, I think, 1969. That they made that trip.
71 is what the book is.
71?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's Jack Bailey.
Jack Bailey.
Is a professor.
All right. I became active later. It was probably around 1970. My youngest was about 14. Does that figure? No, if he was born in 66, 1980. I remember he had been watching the television, and there was a program about how if there were a nuclear exchange, we'd all die. And at 14, he hadn't heard that before, I guess. It wasn't part of our dinner table conversation. And he came to me in the kitchen, and he said, is that true? Are we all going to perish? You know, I mean, I don't know what words he used. And I said, well, we're working on it, so it won't happen. We're doing everything we can, and I think we can win this. And after that, I really got active. I thought, This is something I've got to do. So after that, I was kind of, you know, it was like a full-time job. And I did a lot of things. And I can't remember the order. I don't have the book anymore. And I've given away my notes. But I can tell you that it was like a series of boxes. The Interfaith Council was itself a coalition, if you think about it, of churches. And in turn, it was part of a coalition for arms control that I belonged to, that had Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, the Beyond War, SANE, you know, any group that was working to limit arms or to prevent wars belong to that. And so sometimes it's a little blurry who started what. But I know the bus that I rode on in 1982 to go to New York was sponsored by Interfaith Council. And I'm pretty sure that the delivery of those flyers to every house in the county was an interfaith initiated thing.
Tell us about the flyers.
Well, we felt that the government was flim-flamming people by saying, this is the plan. We've got it all thought out. If we know the bombs are coming, you'll be warned, and this is where you go. And it was meant to sort of make people more amenable to business as usual, more weapons, more arms race, more tension. And we thought that was the wrong way to go, that people were being lied to, basically. They were being told there's a way to be safe. And there was no way to be safe. We talked with the director, the county director for emergencies. I've forgotten his exact title. But his office was in a bunker. I mean, it was like a cube of masonry, and you went way down into the bottom, and there he was. And lo and behold, he agreed with us. He was a practical man. And he was probably thinking, how the hell am I going to keep people safe when they're all panicked and they're all driving their cars trying to get as far and as fast away from the city as they possibly can? So he said he did have a little budget, and he could print. He could afford to pay for printing the flyers, but he didn't have money to post them. Remember, this was way before email or anything like that. So we printed these flyers. They had the message that you really won't be safe in case of a bomb. We showed Ann Arbor with the concentric circles and described the kind of damage in each circle. And we sort of invited people to imagine everybody getting in their car at once and trying to go to Dexter or someplace where they'd be safe. And then we had to divide the county into routes that one person could cover all the houses on each route, and then we got volunteers. We had everything sort of packaged in envelopes so that you got the right number of flyers for your route, and we had them all assemble at a place that is still there. It's 310 South Ashley in Ann Arbor. It doesn't matter what it had been. It was a meeting place that belonged to my husband and me, and we were delighted to use it for this purpose. Basically, it's just a big room with a lot of tables, and we could lay everything out, and people could come in one door and go out the other. All day, people were coming and picking up these packets and delivering them. It was one thing to do it in the city. Was the rural routes were kind of different, but somehow or other, we covered the whole county. Everybody got one. That was, to me, one of the most spectacular things we accomplished.
How many volunteers would you say there were?
I don't remember. Might be in the book.
But many.
Many. Oh, yes, many. And I suppose some people took more than one route. Yes, I do. It was a long trip, overnight. I thought one could sleep on a bus, but I was mistaken. The bus driver kept himself awake by playing music all the time, and or listening to the radio, and I couldn't sleep. When we were approaching the city, but at first it was fun. It wasn't all at night. We spent a lot of time folding cranes, you know, origami cranes. And we were doing this to decorate a banner that we would carry in front of us when we got there. And there was a a lot of camaraderie and conversation going on. And then this long, sleepless night. And then as we converged on New York, you could see buses on all the highways, all descending into the city at once. And it was exciting. You knew you were part of something huge. I remember the driver getting out of the bus and just the bus just sitting there for a long time. We discovered later that he'd gone and got himself a cup of coffee. The rest of us were having splitting headaches because of caffeine withdrawal. but anyway, eventually he took us to the place where we were supposed to be and wait for our turn. And we did. We sat on the pavement, and if we had an apple in our bag, we ate it, and we talked with each other. We got a little bit acquainted with nearby groups. It was quite a long time before we got orders to begin marching. I don't think any of us really expected that marching in New York would freeze the arms race. It didn't, you know. But I'm sure that it was significant that so many people turned out. The wheels turned slowly, but in the end, the arms race did kind of slow down and take a different turn. You had to do things to reach more people. My emphasis always was that the peace movement has got to get bigger. It was fervent, but there weren't enough of us to change policy. That's why later, when locally some people wanted to have a nuclear-free zone, which is different from a freeze, I differed with them. That's the one time that maybe, the only one I can remember at present, where I really disagreed with a lot of people in interfaith. Not all of them. Well, I should say I disagreed with a lot of people in the larger coalition. And interfaith didn't take a stand on the nuclear free zone. Perhaps because I was so vocal about it, but I felt that the marching for the nuclear freeze had expanded our numbers because a lot of people could see that this was going to be mutual and verifiable. We had a lot of safeguards built in. This was not unilateral disarmament, and it made sense to them. So I thought, now we're growing. But when the small group brought up that we should have a nuclear-free zone in Ann Arbor, it started to split the coalitions that had been built. The researchers on campus thought that's the end of their work if the city passes something like that. It'll be a court fight at first, but it's very damaging to them. Getting government contracts and so on. Nobody knew how much of it was defense related, but certainly some was. And I said, besides, it looks silly. It looks elitist. It's one thing for, say, Denmark to want to be a nuclear-free zone, but for a superpower, we can't just turn our backs on the arms race. We're part of it. We've got to change the policy, not just declare that our little corner is free. We're better. We're clean. So anyway, it was defeated. It was a popular vote, and people said no. But it had gotten some of us to talking with people who are active in defense research or physicists and so on. And they thought there might be a value in us getting together and discussing what they're doing, why they feel it's right, and what our concerns were. So I wrote this, which it tells about how close we came to having, I think, a really constructive conversation with them, public meeting where many points of view could be expressed. It didn't happen. I think some people were very uneasy about it, and if you read this, you can sort of see how it didn't happen.
Okay.
This tells about the Coalition for Arms Control and how it got started and what we did. We met for years with our congressman, and but interfaith was just one among several in that coalition. And this was a successor coalition. Peace and Environmental Coalition to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. It was called PECON-W. and this continued to meet really through the 90s. We were hoping to have a peace dividend, you know, when the Iron Curtain came down. We thought now we can spend that money on things that would really benefit people, human beings. That never happened. but this tells about that coalition and what its hopes were.
My name is Bart Beaven. Well, I arrived on the scene in late summer of 66, following a 10.5-week tour of the Middle East and Europe, and was sensitized to what was really going on in Palestine, Israel. And it's been my chief social issue, social justice issue, for almost 50 years. I came to Ann Arbor as an associate director of the Wesley Foundation, which is United Methodist Campus Ministry. My colleague, Gene Ransom, was a part of the group that pulled this operation together out of the Washtenaw community, or Washtenaw County, what is it called? Council of Churches. And Gene had as his banner that he was a CO, conscientious objector, in World War II. I had a mentor that I thoroughly enjoyed in all ways, looking at the Christian faith and looking at what it meant to deal with issues that our government, our country were involved in. Barbara Fuller picked up on this fact that I showed an interest in going to Washington with whoever from ICPJ was going, or ICP, in January of 67. And she referred to me as that young minister who had an interest in, and indeed went with the group. It was an initiation in terms of talking with senators, representatives. I don't know that, and I'm going to have trouble pulling his name up, Senator, the Democratic senator, whose wife was all over him about Vietnam, but he was holding fast in terms of what the government was calling for. Maybe that name will pop up, and if you think of it, because he was a long-term senator from Michigan.
Oh, Hart.
Yes. What's his first name?
Phil Hart.
Huh? Phil Hart. Phil Hart.
That doesn't... His wife was ahead of him in...
Yes, and the family, and I think there was a daughter that was also on him about it. Anyway, so it was my initiation to in terms of talking with people in D.C., in government, and what I think most of us sensed was the lack of understanding of what we really were doing in Vietnam, why we were there, and what we were doing. Later that year, that was in January, Bill Coffin made one of his many trips to Ann Arbor. And it wasn't annually, but it seemed like that sometimes because it probably within certain time frames was even within 12 months. But Bill was a chaplain at Yale and had taken a strong stand. And within a year or two of 67, was taking draft board cards from young men who didn't want to be involved in Vietnam. And I'm just kind of looking through here, and I'll go somewhat systematically year by year. And Bill supposedly talked at First Methodist Church for attendance of roughly 200 for what it's worth, and I don't know that it's worth that much. I don't remember, this is still 67, Vietnam summer, and I don't remember it specifically, but it's interesting in terms of 67-68 time frame that volunteers were going door to door delivering reprints of speeches by George McGovern and Martin Luther King Jr. and to talk about war. Then we had a study lectures with U of M people. And at the end of 67, journalist David Schoenbrunn spoke at Pioneer School and at Pioneer High. And again, great attendance, but I don't remember anything specific about that. What I do remember, this reminded me, but in December at the Friends Meeting House, seven draft resistors read statements explaining their refusal to fight in Vietnam. And the 23 clergymen were prepared to counsel on Vietnam. And I was very interested in the list of that clergy, because I know there were some that wouldn't have touched it very often, if ever. They would pass it off onto one of us. I was not included in that list, which kind of surprised me, but was probably a part of my learning process, along with my colleague, giving me the background in terms of preparing to indeed counsel young men as to what their options were and where they were and why they were there and what we might be able to help do for them. Then in February 68, and it seems to me like that's the last time that it talks about what I remember is almost an annual gathering in D.C. 68 was the big one with 60, in 68, February 68, 68 members from the Interfaith Council went to Washington. That was the one where we really, we got to, I don't know that we had talked with Ford. What was Congressman Ford's, President Ford's first name?
Gerald.
That we had talked to Gerald Ford. I don't recall that we contacted him the year before. Anyway, the thing that stuck out was that he kind of passed it off in terms of where he was and what he would say. He said, well, I have to get together with our Republican senator, who was Bob somebody, and figure out where we are on that, as if, you know, that he needed somebody else to work it through, and then they decide where they would be instead of him having that con. At the same time, Phil Hart was still being bombarded, so it was an interesting gathering. But beyond that, the singing of Pete Seeger and Joan Baez, I don't know whether it was 68 or following, but you know, when you get those kinds of singers going, it's tough not to get pulled in and be excited. And as a young person, fairly young person at that point, I thoroughly enjoyed the experience, and it helped me push in terms of Vietnam, while at the same time having the underlying push that I wanted to make in Palestine, Israel, which never got touched while I was with CPJ. Bill Coffin was in town again. Oh, Draft Counseling Center was established by the Interfaith Council, and I'm not sure where that was. I think there was one, the Baptist campus minister next door to me at First Church, First United Methodist Church, had an official kind of thing, and that may have been the representative, although the United Church of Christ had a person over on Monroe Street near the law school that was an older person and may well have been an official person in terms of that. I don't specifically remember ICPJ saying, here, we have a draft counseling center set up. There were any number of us doing it, and for the most part, at least in my mind or in my situation, for the most part, it was my my group of people, so to speak, United Methodists that were coming in, and whether they were part of the program or not, they were the ones. Although I did have a couple, two or three that were outside, and just an aside, I had one of those people that I don't remember doing a lot with, but he came back to town, lives in the West Coast, psychiatrist, and he came, he wanted to make sure that we sat down to talk, because he said, I want to thank you again for saving me from going to Canada. And I said, you want my glasses on?
No.
He said, I came to tell you one day, and it sounded like it was in the hallway, that I decided I had to go to Canada. And you put the brakes on me. He said, wait a minute. Let's talk about this a little bit. He did not have a religious background, but I knew that he had a philosophical background, had some underpinnings in philosophy that would fit every bit as well as religious. And so he moved ahead and went for it and got it. And when he got his CO label, he called his dad and said, Dad, I'm a CO. His father was a World War II veteran who figured I meant company officer. He said, no. So there were some tough times with the family over it. But it was just an amazing thing that came back. This was just a year and a half ago. And I it put me to wonder how many others that I had touched base with that maybe didn't work or whatever. I know several that did, but that was just a bright light for the day, if you will. The end of 68, the Interfaith Council opened the office in the basement of Wesley Foundation. We had an extra room. There was nothing but trouble. It's part down the hallway was a small apartment underneath the major structure. And I guess because of the timing, at that point I had become director because my colleague went on to head campus ministry in Nashville as a national person. And so the Interfaith Council, I think we're working out of Barbin and Russell's home the first couple of years, 3 years, whatever. And they were looking for space that, you know, they could spread out a little bit and people, other people could come in and be doing stuff without coming into the home. And this space was not being used, so I said, you know, so that's where they landed. And it's from the sounds of things, it sounds like they may have been there for 20 years. I know they were there the rest of my time through 75, but I don't know whether that's accurate in terms of just exactly how long they actually used that space. They outgrew it very quickly, I might add.
The space in the Methodist?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I was fairly sure that it went into the 80s, but it wasn't clear to me that it had gone. The suggestion in the book is that they moved again in 88, which would have been 20 years. Okay. '69. Some of us went to Dow Chemical in the spring of '69. To protest the company's sale of napalm. We went the Sunday before to talk with two or three of the churches that we would represent if people knew who we were, and to tell them what we were planning to do and that we would be there for the annual stockholders meeting. The only repercussion I had was that somebody who had seen me that Sunday evening saw me again on that day of protest. He said, "You come from the Wesley Foundation in the NRB, yes. I'm going to write the bishop about you," which I gather he did, but the bishop, I talked to the bishop. He says, "Don't worry." I get those all the time. So it was comforting, but at the same time it was probably my initial somebody saying, "Hey, you know, what are you doing here, clergy? You ought to be working back there." Then in November of '69, I did not go, but the report was that 2,000 Ann Arborites attended the three-day march against death in Washington. What I do remember is that they carried signs listing the names of 1,800 Michigan soldiers that had died so far in Vietnam and shouted their names as they passed the White House. Those signs, those named signs, were all done in the basement of Wesley Foundation, where the office was, but it was because the office was there, and we worked it out so that they could have a little more space to work with. But it was I think, if I'm not mistaken, it was a spray painting. They would have the name cut out, and then they would spray paint. And they were the nicest look. They came back and said they were the nicest looking signs of anybody in the march. But it was a very large march. I had some students. I had one particular female student who said, and I told the group, I said, "You know, if some of you want to go in mass," we had a church bus that I'll talk about very briefly here, I will go. Otherwise, you don't need me. I've been there a couple of times already. You go and experience what you can. But I had one girl who wanted me to know. She said, if anything happens to me, I want you to tell my mother why I went. So I don't think her mother would have said yes if she had known ahead of time. I'm sure she knew, you know, before they were going, because I believe home was Ypsilanti, if I'm not mistaken, but that's a, you know, neither here nor there. But anyway, it was one of the large marches, which they claim, total attendance, 500,000 to a million. I think the 500,000 probably was the better figure. But it was probably it was the largest anti-war, anti-Vietnam gathering in the fall of 69. Oh, it is immediately here. 12 members of Interfaith Council visited American draft resistors in Canada. And for that, because there were 12 of us, and rather than take two or three cars, I drove the church bus. And we had clothing and some other things packed away in the bus to take to these resistors. And I honestly don't remember how many resistors. I don't think it says here. Yeah, it just says draft resistors. But we met them in just across the river and spent an evening with them and came back. And the question was, you know, what are the people going to do at the border? And we didn't have any problems. So it was an evening that was a success and somewhat fun being on a bus together, as it were.